This is Melissa, and today is the 7th of April, 2024, and I hope that you are all doing really well. I also wanted to say really quickly, I thank you for keeping in touch. I've had some nice emails this week. I'm always behind. Sometimes I'm behind as much as a week or more reading them, and then often much longer than that to respond. I try, but I always seem to be behind. But that's not by way of saying don't write, because I find your input to be really helpful, and I appreciate it. I'm apologizing, basically, that I can't keep up. Yesterday, I had a conversation with someone, actually kind of late in the evening, and we were talking about science versus supernatural, or things outside the norm, I guess might be a way of putting it. And he was talking about certain magic rituals being repeatable. And so the magic that was poo-pooed as somehow not having a reality to it. He said these are people who haven't really looked into this. They don't know what they're talking about. Anyway, we talked about a lot of different things. I was speaking with him about paganism and some of the reading that I had been doing during the week on the blending of white nationalism and paganism. And I then said that I probably needed to get off the phone because I had not picked a Redux to go up for today. And I said that maybe I would look for something that Alan had to say about paganism. I found this talk. It is from September 3, 2007. And I said go up today. It's actually really late Saturday night. Usually I do the recording earlier in the day so I can make a video, but I've been kind of dragging my feet. I don't know why. But anyway, this was Republic Broadcasting Network, September 3, 2007, entitled Tricky Techniques for Mass Mind and Trying Times. I had just searched out paganism. And Alan, it made me laugh when he was saying, you know, if you think about the word propaganda, pro-paganda, and that just made me laugh. But he was just talking about, later on in the show, he was talking about older forms of paganism and that they were given many different gods that they could choose from as long as they did their sacrifice. And I was reminded of the movie Apocalypto, because tomorrow we are having a total eclipse of the sun, and this part of Texas, where I'm right in the path here, where we will have 100% coverage of the sun for several minutes, so it will be totally dark or nighttime dark. And I didn't have those viewing glasses that you're supposed to have. And I was with some family yesterday, and they all were talking about their glasses or showing their glasses and saying where they were going to be. And I just, I didn't know that I wanted to make too much of a big deal out of it, but I thought that it would be good to have some of those glasses. My sister-in-law told me to go to a little hardware store in the next town over, that they had them. And so I drove over there this afternoon, and they did not have those glasses. They said that they had sold out a couple of days before, and they'd had like 6,000 pair of them, but they were all gone. I was like, wow. I needed some wood glue to repair something, and so I bought a little bottle of wood glue there at the hardware store, and she told me to have a blessed day. I asked her where she thought I might go to get the glasses, and she said, well, you could try Walmart. I think they've been selling them. So I drove over to Walmart, and I went to the eye department there where I was directed, and they said no, they had sold out like the day before. And I asked them where they thought I should go, and they directed me to a grocery store. And I thanked them, and they told me to have a blessed day. A couple of women. They both said it at the same time. It was nice. So I actually called over to the grocery store that they suggested, and because I didn't want to drive all over the place and on, you know, just on a goose chase. And they said that they had a lot of those glasses. And so I headed over there. And I picked up a couple of things, some butter and a few other things. And I got those glasses and paid for them. And then the cashier, he said, "Have a blessed day." And I thanked him. And I thought about the movie Idiocracy, where Costco has become the store that you do everything at. And there's the big greeter there. And you walk in and he's not even really aware of who's walking in, just there's bodies coming through the door, and he said, "Welcome to Costco, I love you. Welcome to Costco, I love you." And it, you know, I've thought this before about have a blessed day, because I've been back in this area for a while now, and I hear that all the time, and it is sort of robotic, but it also identifies the person who says it as a Christian or, you know, God-fearing. It's sort of a badge, if you will, that identifies them to other people. So the total eclipse, I was listening to Alan's talk on the way into the next town and then on my running around, and he was talking about, you know, the pagans had their choice of gods as long as they did the right sacrifice. And I was reminded of the movie Apocalypto, where they had a total eclipse of the sun. And during the time leading up to the sun being covered and it getting darker and darker, they're doing this frenzied human sacrifice. You know, I think they cut the heart out and threw the, you know, I don't remember now if it's the heart and the head or just the heart. But anyway, it was bloody. And the idea is this priesthood knows what is happening, and they know about how long the sun is going to be covered and it's going to be dark. And they've whipped the crowd up into a frenzy, and the crowd understands that if enough blood is shed, if enough sacrifice is made, then the sun will come back. The priests have promised them that the sun will come back, and indeed it did. That was the third law of Arthur C. Clarke, which is any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. I received an email this week from someone who had listened to some of the things that I had said on the Easter Redux when I was talking about the blending of alternative media with white nationalism. And he gave me a heads up on a really good talk that I'm going to link to that was hosted by Tom Secker. And his guests were Aaron Franz, who did the film Age of Transitions, and Adam from Germany. And Adam is really from New Zealand, but listeners that have been listening to me will recognize Adam because I have done real history with him. And also he and David in England did the latest talk for the book club on the Buffer Fringe. The person who wrote in said that they did a really good analysis of when the alternative media moved away from some of the traditional things that they had been focused on and pivoted over towards the white nationalism or different things, we might put it that way. And he said, "I think this talk is from sometime in 2015. Well, Tom Secker, the host, wrote a book. I don't know that I've got that up in front of me right now. Let's see if I can find the name of that, that I have mentioned before, possibly in writing. But that book is basically, I can't find the title, but it is about the Pentagon and the CIA involvement in Hollywood films. So that's Tom Secker, and I'll link to that. The title of this podcast from 2015 was Neo-Nazism in the Truth Movement. Like I said, it's a very interesting talk. There were a lot of good points that were made as to why there had been there was a failure of the 9/11 truthers to really pull things together. In other words, they had a beautiful opportunity to point some things out in a cohesive way, and there had been a failure there. And they talked about several examples they gave of ways in which the alternative, the truthers, could have made something more cohesive and had just missed opportunities. But Adam made a comment about people identifying as Vikings. This was, part of the neo-Nazi, say you identify as a Viking. And it immediately made me think of the QAnon shaman, the Q shaman at January 6th, what were characterized as a terrorist event, domestic terrorism or riots. I don't want to get too deep into that event except to say that I never saw it the way that the mainstream media portrayed it. That is for sure. I did not see domestic terrorism. I didn't see rioting. I saw a rabble, and I also saw a rabble that had been convened from the highest levels of people, had brought together mostly ordinary people, ordinary men and women who were upset with a lot of things, upset at the trajectory of, mostly they were upset because they perceived that the election had been stolen. And there is so much gaslighting that went on around that election that I don't want to analyze that. I don't want to get into that. But this was a partly manufactured event, I say, from the top, where people seem to have been brought to a place and a time for an event that was somewhat staged so that they could be abandoned. That's how I saw it. I saw normal, average men and women abandoned. And there were many thousands of people who were arrested. I don't know how many ended up being convicted and got jail time, but maybe 500 in that neighborhood, and some of them got very long sentences. One of the interesting things I also want to say, I neglected to mention that Aaron Franz, who did the film Age of Transitions, used some of Alan Watts' voice, voiceover in that film. It's an interesting piece, and I think it came out in 2012, so that's an interesting year. And as you'll recall, Alan Watt himself talked a lot about this being the century of the age of, transitions, the century of transitions, the century of change, et cetera, that big things were to happen in the 21st century right now in this time. And one of the things that the three men talked about on that podcast was that one direction that the truth, the Patriot Movement, had moved in, which was alarming for them to see, was the idea that nothing's real, that everything has been staged, that everything is a fake, that crisis actors were used. Oh, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. Those were crisis actors. And that, sure enough, that happened. So I'm not saying that what happened January 6th was staged in that way, that it didn't happen, that these were crisis actors, although there might have been a few of them. What I am saying is that if you look at the players and the groups, whether or not the leaders of the groups were arrested, convicted, are in prison, are going to have to be in prison, because there were several different groups that I think of as being high profile to that event. And some of the leaders were untouched, which is interesting, and some of them were dealt with quite harshly. And I will say that one of them, Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers, was given an 18-year sentence. Now, Stuart Rhodes is an interesting person. He comes out of Yale, and Yale is an interesting place. And in this talk, Alan mentioned Elihu Yale of the East India Company, who gave the money to start Yale and had said that Yale would produce the kind of leaders that they wanted. So when I look at people, Stuart Rhodes and many others who are brought up into leadership positions, I always remember what Alan Watts said, in that your leaders are supplied. And that's for just about any group or organization that you can think of. Your leaders are supplied. There's Joe Biggs, who was, as far as I know, still imprisoned, and says that he expects that Donald Trump will be giving him a pardon. There are leaders of groups that you would call white nationalist, who were not given any prison sentence. And there's a whole fringe movement, but I don't want to say that it's too fringe, because what I see when I look, not at the alt-right necessarily, but moving over into just the right, into the conservative, into the Christians, maybe I can't even say that it's the area of the world that I live in now, because when I was in Canada, I was aware of people speaking out in Canada who identified as Q, you know, QAnon followers of QAnon. It's all very interesting. Alan said, your leaders are supplied, and that's why he would always caution against joining groups. Because a group can start off seeming to be grassroots with all of the right ideas and the right motivations, and they can be immediately infiltrated, taken off, steered in another direction. One example that Alan had made for just that was We Are Change. Many of the local groups complained that they just have people that would come in, and all of the sudden everything that they were talking about was green and sustainable. So what I see is that the right and the alternative right have been steered in a direction by design that is where the people have been made to feel helpless and hopeless. They've been made to believe that there can be no fair election, that there is not an alternative but to be angry and to lash out, or to hope, as some of these groups who were at the Capitol on January 6th have claimed, that the only direction that is feasible is civil war. And you'll hear that repeated in the mainstream. I have seen that in the Washington Post and the New York Times, that this is where the country is headed. Now we are in another election year, and so I think it's worth bearing in mind what Alan Watt said repeatedly. Our leaders from both sides, all sides, any area, anything that you look at, are supplied. So before I leave the fringes of the alt-right, before I leave the more or less mainstream of the alt-right, which is now not, who knows what they call it. I've been told by people that alt-right is so 2018, so I don't know, you know, whatever they're calling themselves, disaffected, disgruntled people who are lashing out at a broken system and have joined a group. There is the young leader who has said that this is a holy war and Jews should expect to die because Christians are willing to die and it's a holy war, and has whipped up a frenzy and said, Christ is king. And then you've got the female black journalist who's been a guest on every major right, conservative, more or less mainstream outlet, very well-spoken young woman, who's lately been debating rabbis and accused of being anti-Semitic, and has recently tweeted, Christ is king. So when I hear this from such different sources, from a white nationalist with a Hispanic background and an African-American journalist, Christ is king, what I'm hearing is, have a blessed day. I'm hearing code or identifier, this is who I am. It's a way for people to say, oh, I know you, I recognize you. And before I continue with the last bit of thoughts that were bouncing around in my head this afternoon, I want to say something about the basically, if we're talking about science and rationality or the rational mind and logic against a mind that might incline towards the supernatural or mystical way of thinking, I would like you to consider that we human beings, part of what makes us human, are the inconsistencies. We're not robots. And we have emotions. We are emotional, thank God. But the emotional component of us means that we are capable of doing things that are not logical or that don't have consistency, if you will. And when I was thinking about people signaling to others or even to themselves what they believe and what is important, sometimes that is done. I had just posted something earlier today of the little piece that was put together in the excerpt series by a listener. This one was entitled Red String Club, and it was those people who wear the Kabbalah, mostly identified with Kabbalah, red string. And so they're signaling who they are. Well, I wear a crucifix, and now on that chain, I have a little anti-EMF pendant that was given to me. So it's supposed to protect me from electromagnetic frequencies. So I don't know if that works or not, but I have laughed at myself because I'm like, well, shouldn't a crucifix be enough? Like, you know, like garlic or something. I add this pendant in there for that extra protection. But I laugh, and the crucifix itself, I love this, and I thought it was lost during the move, that it was had been broken on the chain that I had in Canada, and but I've got it now, and I love the crucifix for a lot of reasons, but I will say that Alan gave it to me. So we humans who have emotions are not consistent because of the emotions. And this is what the elite know about us, and what has been studied for thousands and thousands of years, is that this can be used against us. This can be played upon. So the title again of this redux is Tricky Techniques for Mass Mind and Trying Times. And Alan is talking about how we're studied and how the propaganda works on us because we are so well studied. And he said, coming out of the medieval era, we truly did belong to a simplistic society where everything was in its place and everybody was in their place. And that was a common expression even in Britain when I was young, he said. Mind your place. Your class system was dictated to you. Then he went on to talk about the plague carts going around in the big cities, the factory cities, and the people dying of malnutrition and overwork, and literally being picked up on these carts, the bodies hauled off. He said this was Great Britain at its height in the empire. And he said, from that age, we came into a short period of individuality. Individualism began to take over, and that in turn created crisis, because for the first time people dared to ask about their institutions, the institutions of government, of religion, that was hand in glove with government and had been for centuries. They questioned everything, and many good books were put out in the early 1900s up to the mid-1950s. And then the governments learned the scientific forms of technique. Psychological technique, primarily to start getting people back under their thumb as a mass conglomerate. So we're not like Star Trek's Spock, all logic, no emotion. And it's the emotion that they use. I had mentioned Elihu Yale and the East India Company, and I was still thinking about the election in 2020 and what has transpired over the last few years, and now we're gearing up for this next, you know, the 2024 election. And I was reminded of what was a huge story a few years ago, and that was the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal. I started to look into that this afternoon again, and things leapt out at me that I hadn't noticed before, partly because, again, the old school ties were on my mind and the interconnectedness, what I see when I look at these events and who we're given that is supposed to be championing our cause, our interests, and so forth. So just a real quick reminder for you, Cambridge Analytica, LTD, previously known as SCL USA, was a British political consulting firm that came to prominence through the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal. It was started in 2013 as a subsidiary of the private intelligence company and self-described Global Election Management Agency, founded by a group of executives, longtime SCL executives, Nigel Oakes, Alexander Oakes, and Alexander Nix. And Nix was the CEO. The well-connected founders had contact with, among others, the British Conservative Party, royal family, and military. They had offices in London, New York City, and Washington, D.C. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but I want you to know that one of the investors was Robert Mercer and his daughter, Rebecca Mercer. And I want to point out that Robert Mercer was a big funder of things that Steve Bannon was involved in. Also, there's a connection there to Nigel Farage. But Steve Bannon was vice president of the company, all right? Is that sinking in? Steve Bannon was vice president of Cambridge Analytica. The scandal blew up in 2018. I think Bannon was out by then, but there are just a couple of things that I want to tell you about here. Hedge fund manager Robert Mercer was a big donor to the company. The company combined misappropriation of digital assets, data mining, data brokerage, data analysis with strategic communication during electoral processes. They were involved in the Ted Cruz campaign and later Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. It says that Boris Johnson sought advice from Alexander Nix in 2016. Bannon's stake in the company was estimated at $1 to $5 million, but he divested his holdings in 2017 when he became Donald Trump's White House chief strategist. The company claimed to use data enhancement and audience segmentation techniques, providing psychographic analysis for a deeper knowledge of the target audience. They used what they called behavioral micro-targeting, and they could predict the needs of the subjects and how those would change over time. Now, for a long time, Facebook said that they had no idea that their data was being used for this method. You know, they tried to keep themselves clean in this scandal. But huge piles of data were scooped up by this company from Facebook. The British Information Commissioner's Office did an investigation and concluded that Cambridge Analytica was not involved in the 2016 Brexit referendum and found no additional evidence for Russia's alleged interference during the campaign. However, sensitive information was passed by a couple of their contractors who were indicted during the affair. And there was a hidden camera that was used on Alexander Nix, and so he was suspended from the company in 2018, and a lot of this broke after that. It said they were accused of using data from 50 million Facebook users to influence the 2016 presidential campaign. Mr. Nix's secretly recorded comments were the main reason why he was dismissed. The recordings were made at meetings at London hotels between November 2017 and January 2018. Nix and two others were speaking to an undercover reporter who was posing as a representative for a wealthy client trying to get candidates elected in Sri Lanka. And Nix told them that the company's potential services included deploying honey traps to target opponents, including secretly filming politicians taking bribes or in the company of prostitutes. He said, "We'll offer a large amount of money to the candidate to finance his campaign in exchange for land, for instance. We'll have the whole thing recorded, we'll blank out the face of our guy, and then we'll post it on the internet." He said another strategy to compromise opponents is to send some girls around to the candidate's house. He said he preferred to use Ukrainian girls. They are very beautiful. I find that works very well. He said, "I'm just giving you examples of what can be done, what has been done." It sounds a dreadful thing to say, but these are things that don't necessarily need to be true, what he was willing to do to help his client. He said, as long as they're believed. He said, often we set up, if we're working, we can set up fake IDs and websites posing as students or tourists, etc. So that is Nick's. Offer them, he said, a deal that's too good to be true and make sure that it's video recorded. Now, I want to tell you something that just happened, a story from today. All we know about Westminster honey trap scandal as mysterious figure targets MPs for nude photos. This is the 5th of April from The Mirror in the UK. It said, a honey trap scandal, which saw several MPs and Westminster staff contacted by a mysterious figure trying to get them to send explicit images, has sparked fears of a blackmail plot. Last night, a Tory MP admitted passing the number of several colleagues and parliamentary workers to a man he'd matched with on gay dating app Grindr. William Ragg, that was the MP, said the person had compromising things on me and wouldn't leave him alone. So he supplied some numbers, names and numbers and personal information of other British politicians. And now they don't know who this is. They said it's so crude it could be, you know, I mean, the typical fashion. They said it's so crude, it's just like the Russians to be this crude. Here it is. Tory MP said it was crude enough to be the Russians. The Chinese tend to be more sophisticated, but there will be more questions in the coming days. Now, Cambridge Analytica is disbanded. Mr. Nix isn't going to be able to have a publicly traded company for another several years. But I wanted to point out that these are old Etonians. They went to Eton, as did Prince Charles and Prince Harry, and lots, I think they said like 10 or 12 prime ministers were Etonians. And that's the connection that you have with the Oaks and Nicks. And there's Nix with his wife, who is a polo equestrian and a billionaire heiress of a Norwegian shipping magnate. So these people are not us. The Nix and the Oaks families go way, way back into the British, what you call the landed gentry. And yes, they have connections to the East India Company. Interesting, don't you think, that that's the company that Steve Bannon is connected with? And Steve Bannon, a book has just been published about him this week called Finish What We Started, The MAGA Movement's Ground War to End Democracy. And it paints an interesting picture of Steve Bannon. I recently was watching a little bit of an interview that Steve Bannon did on China. And this was an older interview from, I think it was about 2 or 3 years old now. He's got this scruffy, needs a shower, needs a shave look, bull in the China cabinet kind of personality. And I've known what I know. You know, he was Breitbart. I knew he was Goldman Sachs banker. I knew he'd been a Hollywood producer. But what I didn't know until I listened to this interview was how intelligent the man was. And I think it might be better to say intelligence, because he had came out of the military. And what was very clear to me was that this was a strategist. So this article from MSN on the book that's just being published about him said, Bannon was not merely a student or passive observer of this prophecy. This prophecy was a 1997 book by historians Neil Howe and William Strauss called The Fourth Turning, which ordered American history into generation-long periods of highs, awakenings, unravelings, and crises, and the book predicted a coming rise of nationalism and authoritarianism across the world and in America. Bannon was not merely a student or passive observer of this prophecy. He wanted to be an agent of it and an architect of the era that came next. So when he watched Trump glide down a golden escalator to announce his campaign for president in 2015, his first thought was, "That's Hitler." By that, he meant someone who intuitively understood the aesthetics of power, as in Nazi propaganda films. He saw in Trump someone who could viscerally connect with the general angst that Bannon was roiling and make himself a vessel for Americans' grievances and desires. Bannon's thinking on building a mass movement was shaped by Eric Hoffer, the longshoreman philosopher, so-called because he had worked as a stevedore on the San Francisco docks while writing his first book, The True Believer. The book caused a sensation when it was published in 1951, becoming a manual for comprehending the age of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. Hoffer argued that all mass movements, nationalist, communist, or religious, share common characteristics and followed a discernible path. The preliminary work of undermining existing institutions, of familiarizing the masses with the idea of change, and of creating a receptivity to a new faith can be done only by men who are first and foremost talkers or writers and are recognized as such by all. But such leaders cannot alone create the conditions that give rise to mass movements. He cannot conjure a movement out of the void, Hoffer wrote. There has to be an eagerness to follow and obey, and an intense dissatisfaction with things as they are before the movement and the leader can make their appearance. Rather than focusing on movement leaders, Hoffer's inquiry concerned the followers, how ordinary people become fanatics. Successful, well-adjusted people did not become zealots. Sometimes they glommed onto mass movements to serve their own ambitions, but that came later. The true believers were seeking not self-advancement, but rather self-renunciation, swapping out their individual identities with all their personal disappointments for a chance to acquire new elements of pride, confidence, hope, a sense of purpose and worth by an identification with a holy cause. Now, Cambridge Analytica, Oaks, remember? Oaks, landed gentry, Eton, all those ties back to East India Company. Nigel Oakes said about his work in advertising before he started SCL and Cambridge Analytica, "We use the same techniques as Aristotle and Hitler. We appeal to people on an emotional level to get them to agree on a functional level." I think there was a lot of good analysis in the talk that Adam and Aaron had with Tom Secker, and Adam's comment about, you know, people want, you know, if you want to be a Viking, connect to your Viking roots. These things, these movements are put out there for us. And I've talked much longer than I meant to talk, and I've talked even longer than Alan's talk will be, so my apologies for that. I'm going to mention really quickly that Scotland's hate crime law went into effect, and guess what? They've had more than 6,000 complaints since the 1st of April, and the police can't handle the volume. Hate crime, right? Describing a transgender person's biological sex is potentially a criminal offense. And now we're got it rolling around up in Canada, Bill C-63. So these are the times that we live in. We are humans, hopefully, individuals still. Be an individual. Don't join a group. Look around and try to just get that bird's eye view and see. Because what I see is whether it's the mainstream right or the alt-right or whatever, these are groups that are controlled. As Alan Watts said, they give us our leaders. So be careful and have a good week.
I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on September the 3rd, 2007. Sorry for the long intro, but I think the wrong number was dialed to begin with. If you check into my website at cuttingthroughthematrix.com and also look into the European site, that's Alan Watt Sentient Sentinel. EU. We can get downloads of transcripts in the languages of Europe. We are in a time of tremendous change. It's been going on through your parents' lives and now our lives, and the children that are growing up now will get the brunt of the changes. And these changes come with what's called technique. Political technique of control, where everything becomes systematized through a network of sciences all working in coordination together.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Hi folks, Alan Watt back here with Cutting Through the Matrix. And I don't plan what I'm going to say. I generally just think about it a few minutes before. Something's been playing on my mind maybe all day long. And just before I came in the house this evening, I looked at the geese that were flying south pretty early, actually, and thinking that some things really don't change, and yet underneath them, everything is changing in the society in which we live. Changing, not just so gradually, it's gone at a fair clip now, yet most people are unaware of the changes because they, being human, they adapt so quickly. We're the most adaptable species on the planet. We adapt to being stopped with police on behalf of mothers against drunk driving, supposedly. And that gets me right back to technique. Technique is not prefaced with psychological technique or psychotronic technique and all the other prefixes which they can use. It means simply the conglomeration of all of the techniques which are used simultaneously on the general public, because we've been living in the age of the mass man and mass management for a long time, and that really started and got underway heavily during the industrial era, and it hasn't let go. The world wars, the great world wars, were total wars where total warfare was acceptable because the weaponry was designed to liquidate military targets and civilians at the same time. There was no distinction. So total war became into being as an output or an outlet of the techniques which were used from the mass man management. Today we're under mass health care and mass this and mass that. Total bureaucratic strangleholds. A time that was predicted by those who understood these sciences and had been taught them. It's only the general public who are kept in the dark. They think they're individuals living in the best country in the world, whether it's across the water somewhere or in the US or in Canada. That's all part of the technique you've been indoctrinated into believing, because all governments treat us all the same way. They use propaganda. And even during World War II, so-called democratic countries found themselves using the same exploitation of emotion by propaganda use to try and drum up support to fight their enemy. This is the Hegelian dialectic, which is an automatic thing as well as a planned thing. When you understand that what you fight against you become, then you understand the process, the law of nature, as they called it in much more ancient times. You can direct it and control it, and we have been controlled for a long, long time. Coming out of the medieval era, we truly did belong to a simplistic society where everything was in its place and everybody was in their place. And that was a common expression even in Britain when I was young, was mind your place. Your class system dictated it to you and you didn't try and rise above it. But that was a common thing to hear not so long ago. The whole idea of the feudal system was a hierarchy from the king down, and above the king was the heavens and a god and angels and a hierarchy of angels. And so as above, so below, you had the same system on earth from the king down through his barons and lords and all the rest of it down to the peasant. That's how it was structured on those premises. Very simplistic. You didn't have to know anything, find out anything. It was all given to you in little stories from the Bible. That's all you would be taught. People were kept in ignorance of other countries at the bottom as well. So much so that when the Spanish Armada came into Britain and many of the ships floundered through a storm onto the shores of Britain, Frenchmen were actually being hung. But along with the Frenchmen, but were also monkeys that were just the pets of sailors. Because the Englishmen had been drummed up so much, the peasantry, that they believed the propaganda that these enemy Spaniards looked like monkeys. And they hung the monkeys, the pet monkeys. That's what propaganda can do to the mob. They always target their enemy and dehumanize them. We saw this in World War II, where every Japanese guy had thick glasses and buck teeth. Same idea on every poster. Look up the posters. There's actually websites there where you can find them, and you'll see how your government can smear any people when they want to target them. This gets me back to technique again. Technique is something which is discussed in high bureaucratic positions, because all decisions in governments now are to do with the mass man. The politician, too, gives his spiels out to the mass man with all his promises that you're going to have utopia tomorrow. All you have to do is vote for him and magically it will appear. And these are the lies that the public have been trained to want to hear. In fact, most of them do want to hear that everything's going to be fine in a patriarchal type society where Big Daddy promises to make it better. If you cut your knee, he'll kiss it and it's all better, just like a little child. And that's the simplicity and how ridiculous the whole system is in its simplicity. It works for children, and here it is supposedly working for adults. Because we came out of the age of very communal living, of the feudal system, the simplistic age, into an age of every man for himself. The bonds of the old community were torn apart as vast amounts of people moved in to the cities for work. They were thrown off the land, in fact, through acts of parliament throughout Europe. And they didn't have anyone to fall back on, and they had to really find out fast for themselves to survive. Survival was a tough thing back in those days. The plague carts that used to go around the big cities, Manchester and Birmingham, the factory cities that were thrown up, went round every day just to collect the dead who died of malnutrition and overwork and all the rest of the stuff, because there were no safety laws in those days, and you'd be on your feet 16 hours minimum per day. And that went for men, women, and children. That was when Great Britain was at its height with the empire. From that age, we came into a short period of individuality. Individualism began to take over, and that in turn created crisis, because for the first time, people dared to ask about their institutions, the institutions of government, of religion, that was hand in glove with government and had been for centuries. They questioned everything, and many good books were put out during the early 1900s up to the mid-1950s, and then the governments learned the scientific forms of technique, psychological technique primarily, to start getting the people back under their thumb as a mass conglomerate. They studied primitive tribes and found out that tribes will push someone out of their tribe if they don't conform or they show different behavior or simply don't agree with the rest of them on something. People, unfortunately, like everyone else, to become like themselves. The primitive tribe does not tolerate individuality very well. So here we are progressing, supposedly, through a new phase of individuality, and yet the governments themselves, out of necessity, because governments must always go this way, when they're collecting taxes and creating more bureaucratic positions and levels above the people, can only treat everyone as a mass and not as individualistic. That's the problem today. We've been put back into this mass grouping, while at the same time we're told we're individuals. This ends up being totalitarian, ultimately, because it can't go any other way. We find that with the rise of police, that's always the first symptom of totalitarian governments. The police becomes to embody the whole fabric of society. They're like the badge of society, because they themselves are now studying their own techniques, as their tenets of law, the rules. They have committee meetings on what to do next, and next, and next. And every police chief wants to be promoted above his present position. And when he looks at his last police chief that was there, he'll say, well, this guy did so many write checks per year, let's double it, triple it, or whatever. And so you end up with them all with their little new formulas of how to get more and more work done, sort of make work projects for policemen. And this is augmented on television with various statistics always contradicting each other, with rises in crime, and others will tell you that the crime rate is actually dropping. When there was a shooting in Toronto, as a good example, a few years ago, this young, white, blonde girl was getting married. She was shot in a restaurant, and the media went into the panic mode right away, or to panic the public, I should say. And it was overblown, and they did a survey in Ontario, in Canada, to see if people had been affected by this one shooting. And they interviewed, they showed on the media all the ones who were terrified now to go outside their doors. In a city of millions of people, suddenly they were terrified to go out their doors because the media had, just like psychic driving, repeated this incident over and over and over again till people were becoming neurotic. That's the technique of mass manipulation that goes on in our society. I'll be back after these messages. Alan Watt back here with Cutting Through the Matrix. I'm going through some of the psychology that's used on the masses to really imprint you from a very early age that your country is right, regardless of what country, in fact, you live in. They all have their national anthems. They have their school songs. They have their propaganda. Propaganda. It's an interesting term, propaganda, for pagan, you know, pro-pagan. Interesting term, which is very, very old again in itself. And we're given this conditioning so that we automatically respond to these anthem songs and favorite tunes, mainly in time of war, when your leaders want you to go off and kill someone or rob someone else, always for what appears to be good reason, until you dig a little bit deeper. It doesn't take much digging usually to find out it's to do what wars have always done. They're economic wars so that a few will be benefited. Today, and it's not just a few, today it's corporations. We've been living in the world of corporations internationally for a long, long time. These are corporate wars, and fascism is, in fact, corporate warfare really carried to an extreme. We find that the biggest companies in the U.S. and in Britain and elsewhere funded IG Farben, which funded the whole war machine of Germany for World War II. You had IT&T that made the Focke-Wulf fighter for Germany. You had the GM and Ford in there who got bombed towards the end of the war, and they sued the U.S. and Britain for bombing their factories. And in the late 70s, they won their case, and the taxpayers of Britain and the U.S. and Canada had to pay up for all the damages That's business, folks. War is business, you see. And we all pay for it over and over again. This is kept from the public, of course, because we're supposed to think that things happen spontaneously and we'll go off to fight just bad men. And that's what George Orwell was warning us all about, how these techniques are used on us over and over again. He was actually asked in the book 84, Winston was asked, who are we fighting today? Because they kept changing targets from East Asia and West Asia and signing agreements and treaties with one and fighting the other and then breaking it and reversing it. That's what we've been doing now in this Third World War that we're presently in, because remember, it started with Gulf War I, in fact. And Gulf War II, supposedly the bad man, was based in Afghanistan. So we went off to fight in Afghanistan looking for the man in the cave, the caveman, only to find out later we'd swapped the sites and put them on Iraq instead. And out in an inquiry, George Bush actually said to the inquirer, to the actual lawyers, he said, oh, I never said that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. He said that he was just a bad man and the world's better off without him. That was the excuse, supposedly, to get into Iraq. However, it was much more than just getting in. It was nothing to do with Saddam Hussein. It was to grab the oil and standardize the Middle East, because the totalitarian system we're in is a global system, has been for a long time, and everyone must be standardized under the one system. Before that, communism was a technique used. It wouldn't have mattered if it was Nazism that won or communism in Europe, because both of them use the same techniques to achieve the same goal, and that's the takeover of one country after another, brainwashing the first generation of children who grew up thinking it's all natural, creating the same standardized system throughout Europe. That was the goal of communism. Vietnam, when the American troops went into Vietnam, it was the greatest thing that ever happened for the elitists and the globalists, because they could not unite all the warring tribal factions inside Vietnam. And the communist group was a small group, but it was the best organized group. So when the Americans went in, the communists had all the ability for propaganda, and they became the main party. So the U.S. helped unite Vietnam. That's now a member of the United Nations. And it's a democratic country, meaning it works and has the same rules as all the other international companies called countries. That's what wars are for, standardization purposes. And when you can't get people to be cohesive, you get a common enemy that invades them, that pulls them together. And out of it comes a dialectic where they become the same as you. The Spartans found that out a long time ago when they successfully held off the moneyed boys who'd taken over other countries and were intent on bringing Sparta under the same rule. But eventually Sparta became the same as the ones that were fighting when they adopted the same techniques. The Hegelian process always works that way. You become that which you hate in the long run. Governments always use a facade of legitimacy when they want to attack someone. We find that with Philip IV of France, for instance, when he got teams of monks and clerics to go through the laws to give him permission to attack who he wanted to attack and do what he wanted to do. We find the same with Richelieu, who gave the theory of divine rights of kings to justify his king doing what he wanted to do. Back after the following messages. Alan Watt back here with Cutting Through the Matrix, trying to explain, maybe a little disjointedly, how we got to where we are and where we're going. But it's to do, as I say, with the building of corporations. Go back into the history of the British East India Company, see how far back it goes, and you'll find that even Elihu Yale was one of the founding members, the guy that put the money up to set up Yale University, where he stated this would turn out the future leaders of this country and ensure they'd never lose control through their generations. That's how far ahead these families and money plans their future. we live in a society that didn't simply evolve to where we are. Nothing in the structure evolved to where we are. Whether it's the hula hoop or roller skates or whatever is given to you for the present fads, they're thought out in advance. Many ways of passing your time are thought out in advance by high institutes. Things that keep you preoccupied and stop you from thinking. In the 1800s, when they knew through all the mass rising movements that were coming up with the Chartist movements, the public would eventually demand rights. And the managers of all the big factories were terrified that time on their hands might lead to nefarious deeds, like discussing their grievances amongst them, and who knows where that would lead eventually. And therefore, they gave them all kinds of activities. When they did give them 10-hour working days and weekends as well, they gave them all these kinds of hobbies and sports. That's when they gave them the sports and started off soccer clubs and so on, to keep them occupied, because idle time and idle hands causes mischief, apparently, and communication might develop communication of all the problems that they had and the grievances, and they might demand more and more, and who knows where that might lead. Then they brought out the penny novels, because they had to give them a basic education so that they could at least work in the factories, read plans, and communicate with each other with notes, etc., and read instructions for the machines. So they brought out penny novels to keep them occupied with fiction rather than give them non-fictional works. They didn't want them to be too well educated, you see. And nothing really has changed. The educational standards have plummeted over many years now, deliberately, because John Dewey himself, who wasn't the founder of the present education system in the Americas, but he took over from Manning, he actually said in his own books that all divisiveness, all history that had divisiveness in it, that causes conflicts between different peoples who've been exploited by one or the other, had to be removed from the history books. And it wasn't just for the Americas, it was for Europe as well. And that's something I found out very early on. They had been doing it long before I was born, because when I checked with the reference libraries and checked very old books, I could not believe how much history they'd gotten rid of, including who perpetrated what on whom and why and all the rest of it and who benefited. All removed from the history books to give us this wonderful view of the past that never existed. It was also interesting that big foundations paid novelists from the 1800s on to write dramatic, wonderful childhood stories, such as Anne of Green Gables, where you had this wonderful upbringing. And when you read those books, you think, I guess everyone was the same. And it was all part of a propaganda exercise to change our view of reality, and to make us think that the ogres that ran the system in the 1800s and 1900s were no longer in existence, or perhaps they'd evolved themselves and become better people. That's how it's done. Most of our history is in fact fiction, at least the stuff that you buy on the regular bookstore shelves. At the other side of it, we have the bizarre and the fantastique. Because the New Age religion, which has been pushed to take over from the old, not by an act of any deity or god, but an act of think tanks at the top. Think tanks employ people like Mikhail Gorbachev, who said in his own book that they would create a new religion for the New Age. And in the same book, he mentions that he himself is an atheist. It's called Towards a New Civilization. You should read it. And they did, and suddenly all the New Age books flooded the bookstore shelves. And I know people who are Wiccans, and I asked them where they got all their rituals and so on from. And they told me from the bookstores. And I said, did it ever occur to you that these books that suddenly appeared by the masses and all the religious, where Bibles and so on used to be, are maybe getting put there deliberately? They're so cheap as well. And it hadn't occurred to them, of course. They just take, like most folk, they take everything for granted. They don't do much thinking. And sure enough, all these books suddenly have all rituals and so on. They're all recent things and made up, but they don't know that. And they call religions, when you show them the evidence, they don't want to know it either. But that's the beauty of religion. It's unverifiable belief, and it can't be proven by anyone. Therefore, it can be argued forever. So nothing, as I say, in your culture or society or the age you live in is there by chance. They also knew that at the fringe of all societies, there is a fringe group. Fringe groups can be very useful at times. The radical types, the ones who are left out on the fringes, who can't really fathom things, but can be easily led. And so they gave them a lot of science fiction-type books, eventually dropping the title science fiction, but using the same formats, and they make the people believe anything. Remember that Lord Bertrand Russell said himself, and he worked for the Tavistock Institute and was responsible for many of the formats that are now coming down today in society. He said there's no nonsense so arrant that it cannot be made the creed, that means the belief of the vast majority, by adequate government action. In other words, they can make the public believe anything eventually, with enough propaganda, enough sources, all seemingly unrelated, saying the same thing. And they take years to build up some of the fallacies that they're pushing today. Years and years go into it, coupled with special departments within even the secret services that work for government. We know, for instance, that some of the radical feminist leaders in the United States that started off the New Age as well were funded by the CIA from the beginning and the magazines that they put out. So nothing, again, is there by chance. You have to question everything in the society because all segments of society are catered to by the think tanks, and the think tanks at the top are all connected together. You have specialized divisions and subdivisions for different categories of peoples to make sure everyone gets their dose of indoctrination, belief systems, and all the rest of it. We tend to forget that before Christianity, the world had been run for thousands of years by paganism, and that worked just as good. But paganism was a mass religion. You had a choice of picking which deity was your favorite within a certain amount, a sort of limited choice given to you. But as long as you sacrificed to it and gave obedience to it, you got along okay in society. If you didn't believe in it, they'd kill you. They'd stone you to death, because that's the nature of the mob. And that came into Christianity, unfortunately, the same way. The Roman Church adopted all of the old paganism that it had been at war with, and gradually over time became the very church embodying it all. That's why it's called universal. It took all the old religions and put them into one. And the son who dies for the father or to save the world was nothing new, because Osiris was doing it every year in Egypt for a long, long, long time before. Osiris, the father of the sun, or Ra, gave his blood, shed his blood at sundown. The sky turned red every day, and he saved it because he loved the world. He did it that way. That's how religion is used very effectively to control vast amounts of people without them ever knowing what's really going on. And when you're taught a religious belief, you'll then bounce all your experiences in life back to that religion for verification, which will try, and you'll try and fit it into a pigeonhole off your religion, and it must fit one way or another, or you simply, it's like putting something that's too big in a box, you've got to stamp it in to make it fit. And that's how it sounds so ludicrous to outsiders who are not believers in that same religion. And that's also why religion, you'll notice, is written in the dialectic, because for every statement there's an opposing statement, and that's why they fight amongst each other so much. Every single statement has an opposing statement contained within, by design. Because underneath it all, in the esoteric, is simply the two natures of man at war all down through the ages. the one who can control himself, the idealized man, which really has never existed, or the base man, who simply grabs and takes what he wants and envies, etc. That's what the dialectic is within man himself. And that's why you have the opposing statements in all holy books. You go back to the Buddha, same idea. The Buddha came along. Supposedly, we're told, anyway, there's no verification, he actually existed. And said, this works for me, why don't you try it? But he wouldn't go in to metaphysics. The later disciples mentioned that they weren't happy because he wouldn't touch metaphysics. And he came to actually break the bondage of the belief in reincarnation. This eternal circular hell, as he called it, had to be broken because the people were under the slavery of the Brahmins, where they had no choice. They believed in predestination. They'd been taught to believe in it. This was your place, working in this field your whole life, and you couldn't do anything about it, accept it once again. If you break it, you'll break the karma, and you'll come back as some lower animal. However, once he was dead 200 years later, just like Constantine did for the Christians, they had a meeting with all the new schisms of Buddhism, and they set down the tenets for Buddhism, the law for Buddhism, and they brought back into it all the old Hinduistic beliefs that the founder tried to break. And that, again, is the nature of man. But Christianity, for the first time, there was a hope of individual salvation. There was a hope that the individual, for the first time, could go by his conscience against the government if it conflicted with what he thought his deity wanted. That had never happened before in paganism. And yet, the base man always conforms in a group to each other, and then they go after the religion with the most laws. And so they adopted primarily the Old Testament, because most folk in religion simply want laws and rules set out for them. They don't want to do much thinking. So Christianity pretty well died fairly early on, as far as a revolutionary force, and that's what it initially was. You'd never know that listening to the conservative Americans of today. I get calls from people in Europe who haven't had the same indoctrinations in religion or tradition that the U.S. has had, and they'll mention some of the shows I'm on and how the people seem so religious, and it becomes confusing. And I tell them that you can only go by what you can verify for yourself. Anything else is belief in religion, regardless of the religion that it happens to be, is unverifiable. When it's a mass religion where people go together and do all the same rituals together and everything is together, then it's a social religion. People like social units. They like everything to be the same as themselves, dress the same, say the same things, have the same parrot phrases that they come out with. It makes them feel safe and secure to have others the same as themselves. That's primarily the function of religion. But yet people who have no idea and haven't read the histories of their own religion are easily manipulated by the psychopaths in power today. We find religious terminology being used to motivate people like a conditioned response, which it is in fact. When they talk about evil empires, and Ronald Reagan took over and he called different countries the evil empire. The Soviet Union was the evil empire. Colonel Gaddafi for a while was the evil empire, the embodiment of the devil. That was to get all those in Christianity in America to back him. And it happened very well. It worked very well. They thought he was a great guy for using these terms and invoking God on the enemies. And that's what it really is. It's invoking your deity, very primitive thing, to cause wrath on your enemies and to back you up for what you intend to do to them. So religion has many, many functions. And what we have today, getting back to technique, are scientists who understand all of this very, very well. And Aldo Huxley, in many of his talks to the Ivy League universities, used the term often, technique. he was talking about psychological and behavioral control of mass groups or whole nations and eventually a world, in fact. That was what the whole Tavistock idea was about, to initially use propaganda to persuade and then use other techniques to reinforce that on top of it until you had whole nations who responded automatically to catchphrases and buzzwords, just like the Christians had done for centuries when their leaders wanted to go off and pillage abroad. We forget that the Crusaders used the same thing. They had to go and save the land of Jesus. Even though Jesus was long, long gone, they used that as an excuse to go and plunder the Middle East. And plunder they did, because booty was the way that the knights paid themselves. They stole everything. That was called plunder and booty and loot. And it was quite acceptable in those days. But they were under the banner of Christianity. The Knights Templars were no different. They were not a good bunch of guys at all. They were a secret society that eventually merged with the Ashashim or the Ishmaelis, the guys who were a much older secret society than themselves and were taught all the tricks of the trade from those guys. I'm talking about the techniques that are used on us over and over again. Always with the same high-sounding words and in a language that the public can kind of understand or have been conditioned to understand, but always for an ulterior purpose. It's interesting that the Ben Laden family, the family were lifted out the day after 9/11 out of the U.S. because they'd been there in New York for a meeting with the Bush Company because they own the largest construction business on the planet, to do with underground bunkers for wealthy families across the planet. Isn't that amazing that one of them is a president who's in a school supposedly when 9/11 goes down, and the father, the ex-president, and the head of the CIA was at a business meeting with the Laden family in New York at the same time. What's the chances of that happening in a population of 7 billion people on the planet? What's the odds of that? Just incredible. And yet that's the sort of stuff we're fed, and we munch our chips away and drink the beer and think nothing of it. This is incredible, really, what's going on to get the world into a huge war, a world war, a war to change all of society and to get rid of individuality once and for all. The biggest problem they've ever had is the thinking individual. And they plan to treat us all the same, go through the same conveyor belt, go through the same machinery, and all be exactly the same standardized world. That's what they call their utopia. Their utopia is our hell, in fact. A standardized world where you can't make a decision for yourself because the state will be doing it all for you. The Soviet were exactly the same. They would pick children at school, very, very young, and tell them what they were going to be trained in their schooling, and that's all they would be taught. They didn't get taught extra subjects that had nothing to do with their particular indoctrination. That was the choice in the Soviet Union, and the West looked upon that greedily because they thought if only we could use that same system here, how fantastic it would be. So they came up with their own versions of it. And they have them implemented into the educational system now. They want efficiency at all costs, and they want a society where no one will exist without serving the state. That's the world they want, a world where the infirm, the sick, those who don't come up to their new standards will be simply eliminated eventually. That's the system. And it all comes under what they call the top technique, the technique of control, and we're all going through it now. That's why there's so much confusion. The public are punch drunk with conflicting information put out deliberately to keep them in this strange sort of mindset where they can't figure things out. Well, that's about it for tonight. From Hamish and myself up here in Ontario, Canada, it's good night to me. Your God or your gods go with you.